The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're learning how private enterprise is jumping in to fill the gap left by shrinking government budgets for space exploration. Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. Here with me is Elmo Keep, an Australian writer and journalist whose work has been published with Matter, The All, The Rumpus, The Monthly, The Saturday Paper, The Sydney Morning Herald, on ABC TV and elsewhere. She's also the digital director with the arts and culture magazine, The Lifted Brow. Welcome to the show, Elmo.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Okay, so I've been wanting to talk to someone about the Mars One project for a while, but most of the stuff out there was either extremely vague, extremely biased, or both. And you recently published an article about Mars One for Matter, which our listeners can find in the Medium Network, which was titled All Dressed Up for Mars and Nowhere to Go, which was absolutely fascinating. Before we go too far down the rabbit hole, I want to make sure all of our listeners are up to speed on what exactly Mars One is. Could you give us a little background on Mars One for the uninitiated?
They are a very small number of people who are working to get a privately funded one-way mission to Mars to happen. Their idea is to bring costs down by sending people only one way, and they're going to establish a colony there, and that this is going to happen by 2025. So how are they going to get the money that they need to buy from private enterprise? So places like people like SpaceX and Paragon Space and Lockheed Martin and people who do have actual legitimate contracts with NASA, that's who Mars One proposes to buy the technology from, which costed around $6 billion, saying landing people there will cost that much money. And they're going to get that money by producing a reality TV show that is going to run for 10 years. So from when the final crews are chosen, they're going to be training for 10 years on Earth in everything that you need to know to become an astronaut. And then they are going to be sent to Mars one way. And this broadcast will take place on Earth, and then the broadcast will take place throughout the mission and then forever after. So they base the figures on where that money could be raised by looking at the most recent cycle of the Olympic Games, which generates significant money, $8 billion, through broadcast rights, merchandising, advertising. So their idea is that they can create an entertainment property that is comparable to the Olympic Games, and that from there they will have the funds to send these people. So if you look at that, there are a huge number of problems with how that would work.
Can you give us an idea of the range of people you talked to as part of your research for this story?
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of it was for background, and you know, you couldn't put 15 different characters into a story. So a ton of it was, you know, people who do psychometric testing on putting teams together, like how do teams work well together? People who are working on high seas, which is an analog on Earth for a long-term isolation chamber. People who work at Lockheed Martin, for example, people at NASA, people in the various Mars societies around the world. So there are a lot of hardcore scientists, geologists, a lot of people who work in NASA, also a part of the Mars Society. It's a real passion project for people inside NASA. It's not like they're not trying to make this real. They are. And they have a very real concrete roadmap for making it happen. So there was that side. Then there were the people who work in Mars One, who I was speaking with over a period of time. I was speaking with different people on the shortlist for a long time, sort of trying to figure out who, as a journalist, trying to figure out who I would build the story around. So there was a lot of people in the research in trying to get a really broad-based understanding of all of the different elements of a long-term space mission. You know, and then I was able to speak with, you know, someone like Chris Hadfield, who is a very famous astronaut and an incredible human being who's really generous with his time. And so, yeah, so all the way sort of top to bottom, from people who are doing behind the scenes work and people who are really well known for working in aerospace.
Can you give us a little bit of an idea of some of the key figures involved? Who's at the helm of this project?
So they're based in the Netherlands. Their CEO is a guy called Bas Landstorp, and his background is he was a PhD researcher and working on wind energy. And he had decided that he wanted to dedicate his energies and life, essentially, to getting people to Mars, to being the head of the company that makes that happen. So he's one person. There is someone else there called Arno Wilders, who also works at ESA. And he wouldn't speak with me, so I wasn't able to interview him, unfortunately, because he is working on a lot of the technical side of the mission. So that was hugely disappointing to me he didn't want to be interviewed. And then there is another guy called Norbert Kraft, who's their chief medical officer, who's actually gone through the people who applied and is interviewing them and in working on choosing the final selection of people. So that's pretty much the core people behind the company.
Okay, can you give us a little bit more detailed information on the timeline for the Mars One program? At what point are they expecting to have finalists versus finish training the finalists versus launch versus arrive at Mars?
They, at the moment, have announced the absolute shortlist of people, which is down to 600, low 600, so 638, I believe it is. And that is the most recent announcement that they've made. So between when they are saying they're going to land on the planet, which is 2025, and now, it would look like they would be really shortly within, you know, the next year at the very latest, choosing the final, what they say is going to be 24 people who are going to be hardcore, you know, trained up to be astronauts, despite the fact that most of them don't have the background that's required to become an astronaut. So it's 10 years from that to landing, and that is incredibly ambitious.
Do they have any idea how much this will actually cost?
Their estimate is $6 billion is a figure that has been going around. How exactly they can get it down to that is not really ever clearly explained. That just seems to be based on the idea, okay, so private companies are going to be creating this technology, and therefore it's going to be cheaper and cheaper. And so by the time 10 years from now, the projection is that's how cheaply we could do it. It isn't based on any real hardcore analytics of costings. It's just a really optimistic idea. And so the MIT paper that we linked to that I mentioned in the piece, did very precise measurements on how many launches would be required, how long it would realistically take, and how much it would cost. And just the launches of 15 Falcon Heavies is $4.5 billion. And that's just the launch that's required to get everything that they need there. The biggest concern in this that I came away with is that that's only in the best of all possible worlds, let's say that that is possible at that little amount of money to make this happen. That's only getting them there. That isn't then forever after servicing them and resupplying them. And where that money would come from is incredibly mysterious and vague. So I would be very worried about that if I was someone who was potentially going to be taking part in this mission. How am I going to be kept alive once I get there?
Again, we're talking about a reality show here. Is there a partnership or a potential partnership with a broadcaster of some type? I'm presuming there would be some international interest here so that we'd be talking about multiple different broadcasters.
That's right. So they have announced a partnership with a production company, with Endemol, who are interested in producing this show with them. But so far, all that they have confirmed and announced is that they have a partnership. They haven't said, yes, we have a commission in place for a series, or yes, we have a commission in place for a pilot. It's just an agreement to work together, theoretically, on a show that would come out of this project. So there's no network has bought the rights. It doesn't exist yet as a property that they could sell yet to broadcasters.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about some technical partners as well, because there's a lot of technology that we need in order to go into space, get to Mars, set up a colony on Mars. How much of this technology actually exists right now?
Well, NASA is about to launch the Orion spacecraft, and when this story goes to air, we will know how that went. So as far as a rocket that is possibly capable of traveling that distance, that is what we have as of now. That's what exists right now. In terms of a craft that would carry people, that doesn't exist yet. In terms of what kinds of materials they would be able to use, work, live with, construct, be able to maintain once they get to the surface of Mars and deal with its radiation environment, that's completely unknown. And so that's why when you look at NASA's roadmap, it's tiny steps towards doing something as enormous as building a settlement on that planet. Like, the first thing is to successfully get far enough and land it with people in it. That is going to be the most historic moment in human science since the moon landing. So it isn't just a matter of getting the money and then this technology will magically exist and then we'll buy it from someone and then we'll just send our own people, which is Mars One's plan in a nutshell. It just is not that easy. And I think that it's a really very arrogant way of looking at these incredibly complex problems to sort of reduce them to that kind of, if only we had money, if only NASA had more money. NASA works at this and has been for decades and will continue to. So it isn't a matter of impatience. It's like, these things are so unbelievably dangerous and so incredibly difficult. It's why there's reasons why it takes so long for these breakthroughs to be made.
And the technology cap isn't the only hurdle between us and Mars. There are a lot of biological and medical problems involved here as well, just with being that long in space. Can you run us through some of the medical concerns?
Well, that is a huge part of NASA's plan as well, to be able to even see how are people's bodies going to cope, what is going to happen to people physically and, more importantly, psychologically. They're equally as important as each other, but so few people have been into deep space or out of, you know, even Earth orbit. As far as deep space goes, the moon is as far as people have gone, which is really, really far. But this is a really small number of people to be able to build a medical literature around. So it's incredibly difficult to predict because the pool of people to choose from is so tiny. The observations are so limited because there's been so few subjects. So there's things like the bone density loss, the muscle mass loss, the difference in circadian rhythm when you're not being, you know, woken up and setting with the sun. There's isolation. There is the psychological, what could possibly go wrong is just, it's so frightening, which is why it's so pored over and so carefully calibrated in experiments by NASA, trying to figure out how people will be able to psychologically withstand the vast, vast distance that's going to separate them from their home and where they are. And how do you ensure that people remain harmoniously working together? How do you deal with people when they do, if they do, psychologically break down or just have incredible difficulties that we don't know yet? Like, there's no way to know how that's going to affect a human mind because no one has ever been that far. So these are all the things that thousands of people are working on behind the scenes to try and minimize all the risk as possible, as far as possible, before any person would ever be sent on a mission.
And of course, with Mars One, there's an additional psychological factor that we don't have when we're talking about NASA, which is these people aren't coming back. They're essentially signing up for a one-way ticket.
That's right, which is not something that government agencies would ever be able to do in terms of ethics. They would never be able to send people out into deep space with no way to retrieve them or bring them back. So the thought of living your days out on Mars is probably not appealing to almost all of us. But there are the small number of people who would take enormous risks and are willing to do things that everyone else thinks is crazy. And those people are the kinds of people who have taken us, you know, in those great leaps. But it just seems like something so impossible to comprehend from our earthbound perspective. You could agree in any number of ways, yes, I am prepared to do that. But the reality of it is not going to be anything like what people think it's going to be, which is what I came away from talking to David Wilson at NASA about when he was sort of explaining to me, look, in order to be able to do this, everything has to be incredibly simplified and you're going to be living a very 18th century kind of life. So all your tools have to be really simple and able to last for a long, 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 long time. And there's all kinds of other things where it's not going to be this crazy space age vision of the future. It's going to be really, 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 really difficult. And you're going to be living underground and you're never going to feel the sun on your face again. And it's just the more that things stack up, even when in the future NASA has managed to get people to the surface of Mars, how long that they will be able to stay there and come back. And then what's going to have to happen to their bodies in order for them to be able to come back to Earth, how they would be rehabilitated. Those are all things that no one knows the answers to. So there is a huge number of things that exist only in the realm of the theoretical at the moment. And working towards solving those problems are things that take decades. It takes a long time to solve every single one of those enormous problems before safely people could go and come back.
And another consideration, of course, is medical concerns. When we're talking about sending people into the International Space Station, there is an evacuation. There is the ability to get people back to Earth. Maybe not quickly, but within a time frame, I think, that people deem as acceptable. But it's a long way to Mars. It's several months' trip, if I'm not mistaken. And then when you get there, you can't send the first aid kit over. You're there who you're there with, and I'm assuming they would have to have medical training as well.
Yes, that would be part of their training. You know, they would need to be able to perform, you know, like rudimentary dentistry. They would need to be able to repair broken bones. They would need to be able to, you know, suture wounds and do that kind of really basic surgery. But anything were to go more catastrophically wrong than that, you're facing horrible odds of not coming out well. And again, those are things that space agencies work on contingencies. Like, there has to be contingencies for every single conceivable thing that could go wrong. And once that is solved, once people know, okay, no matter what goes wrong, we have a way to deal with that, then we can take the next step. So if you were to look even beyond, if people, let's say everything goes well and they're there and they're on Mars and they're there forever, how are you going to provide the kind of care that's required for people once they become elderly? How would you be dealing with people who were becoming demented, say? There's just so many reasons why it's not a wise plan to just send people there with no way to retrieve them. And for me, that was the real ethical, the wall that I kept coming up against as a writer, just thinking, yeah, people can agree that they're happy to do it. They say, I fully eyes open go into this. But truly being able to comprehend that is different. The reality of it happening to you versus your imagination of how you think it's going to go is different. So that is why, yeah, contingencies have to be in place for every single thing that could possibly go wrong, which is everything from being able to replace and repair any single piece of equipment that you have with you, no matter how tiny. So you're looking at resupply missions that over time would just become heavier and heavier and needing more and more things to keep the colony going. So the costs become exponentially bigger as the time goes on, not cheaper. So, yeah, there's a lot of things about it that are serious issues.
You're listening to Science for the People, and we're talking to journalist Elmo Keep about Mars One, a nonprofit planning to make a reality show out of a one-way trip to colonize the Red Planet. We'll be right back with more after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. We're talking about one possible future for private spaceflight with Elmo Keep. She's the author of All Dressed Up for Mars and Nowhere to Go, an article about the organization called Mars One, and their work toward a reality show based on the exploits of a one-way mission to land and set up a permanent human colony on Mars. I do want to talk more about the ethics here, because I think that's a really interesting part of what's going on and what people are talking about. In the last couple of months, there have been major high-profile failures in the space industry. I'm thinking of the NASA Antares rocket exploding on launch, and not long after, a Virgin Galactic spacecraft crashed and killed one of the pilots. We've had huge successes in space so far, but just getting into space is still really, really difficult, even for NASA, who's been doing it for years. And NASA is a public organization that takes the deaths of its people very, very seriously. So my question is, will Mars One, as a private organization, take its diligence towards safety of its people as seriously as a public organization?
Well, they very openly say, and this, you know, in an interview said the same thing, which was they are willing to accept a much higher degree of risk than NASA or ESA or the Japanese Space Agency or anyone in government would. And that's how they're going to keep the costs down. So they very, very open about that. They're willing to accept a higher degree of risk in order to get it to happen. So for me, as a person who cares about another person who I got to know, who is, you know, potentially going to be taking part in this mission were everything to go right and actually ever left the planet. The fact that the people who are taking that into, you know, taking someone else's lives into their hands, and that they don't agree to as minimal risk as is humanly possible, which is NASA's purview, NASA has to operate that way, I don't think is ethically okay. It didn't sit okay with me, especially because these are other people's lives that they are putting on the line, not their own lives. None of them are going, and they don't want to go, but they're happy to take other people and send them on a really risky mission. And the more that time went on, the more that I looked into it, the more difficult it was for me to sort of reconcile that and not look into it and say something about it in terms of how I felt.
And, you know, if once it gets going, the revenues are not as expected and corners need to be cut, I wonder how much of that information will come down to the finalists, the people who are actually, you know, deciding to go and throw their lot in with Mars One. One hopes that if this actually does get to launch day, that those on the crew will be able to make a final and hopefully well-informed decision on whether they go or don't go.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they do keep reiterating that. They're like, people can leave at any time. People are not, you know, they're not locked in by contract, so they're not prisoners. You know, they're not going to be sent against their will. They have to be very well across the risks, and even with that knowledge, still agree that, yes, this is what they want, and yes, they want to go. So that, in turn, you know, that is absolutely how they intend to deal with their candidates and with their astronauts. But, I mean, there's other things, like if you're looking at a privately funded mission where literally billions of dollars would have to come from companies and from private enterprise, what happens if one day one of those partners goes bust, which happens? Companies, banks collapse. Where will that money come from? What will happen if some huge future conglomerate of a tech company gets broken up and doesn't exist anymore, and they're like, sorry, we really can't afford to keep putting this $1 billion a year into our Mars project? You know, those are the reasons why government funding and accountability that goes along with it is the only way to get these kinds of enormous, enormous projects to become real. So there is just a bunch of stuff when you look into, aside from the fact that, you know, private companies have lost really, really tragically recently their crafts. There's more than that about the risks inherent in private funding. And it's just, it's inherently unstable as opposed to government funding.
And even just talking about things like sponsors, if someone signs on to sponsor Mars One and gives them, I'm thinking, you know, $1 billion a year, say, to help keep the mission going, say they get to Mars, they form a colony, they're there. What happens if something ethical or some kind of strange thing happens, people protest, and that sponsor gets kind of cold feet and backs out? That seems like a hugely massive problem. And I assume there's no contingencies for how we're going to support these people?
No, not at all. Like their financing plan is focused solely on raising this $6 billion just to get it off the ground in the first place. That's as far as they have gotten in terms of what they are publicly sharing about their plan. There's other things like, let's look at $6 billion of profit generated from an entertainment property of any kind. That's bigger than Titanic, Avatar, and the Avengers all put together. That's what you're looking at having to create if you're wanting to be generating $6 billion of revenue that is profit. It is not that easy. It is not easy to replicate the Olympic Games. The Olympic Games is hundreds of years of history and decades of years of broadcast. It's 2 weeks a year for 4 years, and it's basically about betting. You know, sports broadcasts are lucrative because people bet on sports. This is not something that can happen with a deep space mission, a lot of which is going to be frank, really quite boring. Like, you can look at the ISS right now at any time. You can see what they're doing. And when they go out on a spacewalk, it's like, wow, oh my God, okay, they're doing a spacewalk. That is so exciting. But that doesn't happen that often. A lot of the time, they're out there conducting experiments and maintaining the place, and it is not really riveting television. But if it were to be riveting television, it might be something like, okay, these people have turned on each other, or one of them is having a major psychotic event, or any number of the life or death things that could go wrong. I can't see that companies are going to be want associated with that. Advertisers are not going to want to be associated with that. And broadcasters ethically are going to have a huge amount of trouble broadcasting something that could conceivably very easily entail someone's death. So there's just so much that has not been really thought through about this plan, to my mind.
And there's an element of extra reality show that we're talking about here, because when we watch a reality show, say like Survivor, we know as an audience that there's a massive camera crew and medical team standing by to swoop in should anyone get seriously injured or seriously ill. We've seen them do it. We've seen them evacuate people who cannot be on the island anymore because they're in danger. But when we're talking about Mars One, there is no swoop in. There is no save there. It's watching this unfold in a way that's much more real than I think reality TV or the idea of reality TV that we have right now. It feels very Hunger Games to me.
Yeah, doesn't it? It kind of does. It's like the Hunger Games in space. But I mean, there's so much more than that. Like, how are they going to even relay the communications? But how are they going to even be beaming this back? How are they going to be cutting the footage? Like, how is it going to be filmed? The Rosetta probe that just landed on a comet, it was able to historically transmute data for a very short amount of time before it failed, it died. How they are going to advance communications relay, not just deep space exploration technology, but communications technology, to the point where it would need to be in 10 years from now to be able to broadcast live continuously from Mars. That is also technology that doesn't exist yet. So apart from the fact, like you say, we're going to be seeing some really extreme things or some really deathly dull things.
It seems like there's no middle ground there. It's either deathly dull or really terrible.
Yeah. But either way, it's not the kind of, you know, entertainment that we're familiar with. And that was what Chris Hadfield said to me that really struck me and stuck with me, where he was very much saying, look, we will get there. It's going to happen. It's inevitable. It's going to take a long time, but it will happen. It's inevitable it will happen. But we never explored space or the planets to entertain other people. It's not the point of what we do. It's not an entertainment event. So that's sort of really lined up with how I felt about it as well.
We've talked about Mars One. We've talked about the risks. We've talked about, you know, it sounds like it's really improbable at this point. There's a huge amount of risks. And yet there were hundreds and hundreds, thousands even, of people who applied to go to Mars. So what do we know about the people who applied and how the finalists we currently have were selected?
Mars One issued a press release that said 200,000 people have applied for this. And that was never attributable to anywhere other than them. That was not able to be verified in any way. So looking at what's on the record, what actually is able to be verified is that 2,700-ish people put a video application up on the website, which was the final step in applying. You had to pay a fee, and then you had to answer these questions that they had in the questionnaire, and then you had to upload a video about why you should be chosen. So it was 2,700 people who did that, which is not an insignificant number of people who are prepared to die on Mars. And these people range from, you know, people who do have backgrounds in sciences and hardcore science backgrounds to people with absolutely no experience or suitability, you know, whatsoever. Like, initially I was looking into a bunch of people figuring out who to profile, who to build the story, the human angle of the story around. And those people were all in Australia, so it was easy for me to keep in touch with them that way. And, you know, one of them was a woman in her 50s who was a very lovely lady, but who had been an interior decorator. And that was that had been her life. And she's like, you know, I think this would be fun to do this. And my kids have grown up and left home, and I'm willing to do it. And another guy I spoke to was, you know, mad keen into marathon running and fitness. And that was his background. And, you know, those people were on the initial shortlist. And they didn't have PhD backgrounds, science backgrounds, backgrounds in aviation, or in the military, which is traditionally where all astronauts are chosen from. So that was when, and these people who I was tracking, these four people, were all sort of steadily advancing through the shortlist. And that was when I started to feel like, okay, there's something not quite going on here that's right. Because there's no way that someone in their mid-50s with no experience that's relevant, with no peak fitness, with nothing like what an astronaut has to be, and if that's somebody who is making their way through the shortlists, then something is not adding up here. So that was when I started to really sort of drill down into the story more, when that happened.
So do we know how the current set of finalists were chosen? What parameters were used?
No, not really. Presumably they are going to have a selection panel for the final people who are going to be chosen, and that panel is going to be made up of people with much more suitable qualification in terms of choosing space crews. They haven't made that public. They haven't explained that further. And another thing that Chris Hadfield had said to me in our interview was, when you don't know the dimensions of the craft that the people are going to be flying in, you cannot even begin to choose a crew. That's the first step. Like, you cannot even begin to figure out who is going to work well together when you don't have those dimensions. And as the craft that they're going to be flying in doesn't exist yet, then they can't begin to choose these people in the way that NASA would, that every other deep space or any other space mission has ever been chosen, which is just sort of really quite frightening to me, to be honest. It's very sort of disturbing to me to think, yeah, we'll just make this all happen. Like, we'll just plow on and we'll just figure it out as we go along. It's like, it's just not how space exploration works, because it is so dangerous and it's so hard.
You had the chance to talk to some of the finalists during your research for this story. What type of people are they? Did you get a sense of a common pattern or common thread between people who are willing to essentially die on Mars?
Well, Josh was the only person I found who was incredibly aware of the risks and who had a background that was close to what a real legitimate astronaut would have. He's been in the military. He has been in incredibly harsh, arid, dangerous, small team-based situations. He has a degree in applied physics. He's a scientist. And he's in a position where, like every Australian, you have no hope or way of joining a space agency ever. We're not signatory to any space agency here. There's no priority whatsoever for our government to be involved with space exploration. So if you're Australian, you have no hope. And for Josh, he was passionate deeply about space from, you know, being a very small child. and it was something that he never gave up on. And so when this opportunity came along, he applied because it's a long-held dream that he has and there's no other way for him to go about it. To be fair, I didn't get to speak to more than sort of, you know, a dozen people initially canvassing, but he was the only person I found who was in many ways potentially suitable. In other ways not, but in many ways, yes. So, I mean, it's a lot of just everyday people who are like, hell yeah, that'll be fun. I want to do it. And that's sort of as far as their, you know, investigation went. And there was a bunch of people who just wanted to be famous. There was a bunch of people who were just like, that'd be cool, and I would get a lot of attention. And then, you know, obviously when it came down to it, I wouldn't really do it. And a few people who I spoke to, because, you know, I had a lot of hard questions like, you know, how would you feel to never, ever, ever, ever see anyone you loved ever again? Or how would you feel to never be able to do the things that give you pleasure here on earth? If you never do them again, how would you feel? And I sort of discovered in those early conversations that a lot of these people had not really thought about any of that stuff. They just sort of wanted to take part in this crazy idea. But Josh is very serious about it. And I think one way or another, he's going to have a career in the sciences. So he was just such an interesting person and such a committed person that it was obvious that he was the person who I was going to spend my time with.
I think that's one of the most interesting things about the whole Mars One project is when we talk about the project and the feasibility of it and the financial and the ethical and, you know, on and on, I get this kind of lump in the pit of my stomach. And I just start thinking of, are they going to vote for finalists by call-in? Because that's what reality shows do. And then, you know, you read the story about Josh and who he is and how passionate he is about the topic. And you just kind of get inspired. And there's this constant pull between one and the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like, I definitely, like, I mean, I absolutely, in my heart, believe, I don't know if it will be in my lifetime, but I think people will get there. As long as there is some way for the money to become available for it to be invested in, I do think that human drive to explore and the people who are willing to take enormous risks, they'll always be there and they'll always be working towards those goals. But for me, this whole way of trying to do that, I think, is just sort of setting a lot of people up for profound disillusionment, like profound. Like, if you dedicate your life to Mars One's plan over the next 10 years and then it turns out that they're just not able to pull it off, that is a huge, huge risk that you have taken and years out of your life that you've dedicated, and then not really much to show for it. And so that push-pull of, yeah, we need people who are going to do this. We need people who are just total pioneers and completely unafraid. Then there's also, you know, a kind of foolhardy element to that, which is where I think this sort of is more on the side of kind of a fantasy to me, is what it is, how it comes, is how it really looks.
I've read on the internet, because I've looked into this a little bit more deeply over the last couple of weeks, and there's a lot of people out there who straight up think that Mars One is a scam. Based on your research, what do you say to that? Do you think it's a scam?
No, I wouldn't say that it was a scam, because they truly are dedicated to it. They really, really, really believe in it. They really, really believe that, you know, private enterprise and, you know, the media and people who believe in this and want it to happen is enough for them to be able to pull off this plan, no matter how ambitious it is. So they don't have, you know, nefarious or bad intentions. It just seems incredibly, incredibly naive is how I would describe it. They're not at all setting out to defraud people. They're definitely not making money. They absolutely are not making money. So it isn't a scam. It just is, as I described it, it's a hubristic fantasy that I think is more concerned with these people being the people who made it happen. That's what really drives them, I came away feeling. It was like, it doesn't matter so much if people die or whatever, we're going to be the people who did this, not NASA, not all of these people who have been professionally dedicating their lives to making this a reality, behind the scenes, really without glory, just doing their job. We're going to be the ones who made it happen, and we'll show the world that we did it. And for me, that is not a reason or a motivation that I think is admirable or noble at all. I think that that's where the hubris really came into it. So they're not a scam, and they're not trying to do bad things to the people who have put their faith in them. They really think that they can make it happen. I just think that they don't have a firm grasp of the realities.
Elmo, thank you so much for being here and sharing your thoughts. It's a fascinating article and beautifully illustrated with art by Josh Cochran and photographs by Daniel Bode.
Those guys just did such amazing work, and it was such a collaborative effort getting that piece and working with Mark Lotto and my editor there. And I'm really glad. Thank you so much for having me.
If you want to learn more about Australian writer and journalist Elmo Keep or her research into Mars One, you can find the links to get you started on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. In just a moment, we'll be back to get an update on the current state of the for-profit space industry with Space News senior editor Jeff Faust. Stay tuned.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. Joining me now is Jeff Faust, a senior staff writer for Space News, who covers civil and commercial space topics. He has more than a decade of experience writing about space policy and commercial space projects. In 2001, he established spacetoday.net, a website that aggregates links and provides a summary of space news. And in 2003, he started the Space Review, a weekly publication of long-form articles and commentary on a wide range of space topics. He has also worked as a senior analyst for Futron Corporation, an aerospace consulting company, for more than a decade. He has a PhD in planetary science and a BS with honors in geophysics and planetary science. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
So back during the first space race, you pretty much had to be a large country with a NASA-like government agency. When did private space companies start to get in on the space action?
Well, private space companies really started to get involved in the 1980s and 1990s as space technology became more mature, and also as space applications such as communications became more advanced. You started to see companies both developing spacecraft and launch vehicles to place those spacecraft into orbit. These still tended to be large companies, parts of the main aerospace companies like Boeing and Lockheed that had been involved with NASA since the beginning of the space age, pursuing private ventures.
So what does the private space and spaceflight industry look like today? Who's winning and who is putting in, let's say, a less than stellar showing?
Well, what's really happened in particularly in the last decade is you've seen a lot more of these smaller entrepreneurial companies get involved. Companies that don't necessarily have links to these big aerospace companies, in many cases are pursuing different markets than the big aerospace companies. These would be companies like Virgin Galactic on the suborbital space flight side and SpaceX on the space launch side. And they have been pursuing activities such as space tourism, supplying the International Space Station, and eventually carrying people to the International Space Station or elsewhere. And in many cases, they have been working with space agencies like NASA to both support the space agency's needs, but also to win funding to develop their systems. So some of these companies, such as SpaceX and Virgin Galactic, have found considerable success in that area. And you've seen some of the bigger aerospace companies having to play a little bit of catch-up to stay involved and stay competitive in the industry.
SpaceX, I do want to talk about, because that's kind of an interesting story. This is the Elon Musk company, correct?
That's correct.
So what is the history of SpaceX?
Well, Elon Musk started SpaceX back in 2002. He had made hundreds of millions of dollars through other companies, most notably PayPal. He had been interested in space. He was interested in particular, he wanted to fly a greenhouse to Mars. He got frustrated, though, trying to arrange a launch of this mission. He looked at options in the U.S., and they were way too expensive. He went to Russia to try and negotiate a deal to launch a spacecraft and what was basically a converted intercontinental ballistic missile, but wasn't able to work out a deal. And so he realized that, you know, there was an opportunity here in this frustration he experienced, and decided to develop a company that could do launches for far less money than existing companies. It can cost $100 million, for example, to launch a communications satellite, but can make many times that over its 15-year lifetime. That works for the communications satellite market, but it doesn't work for a lot of other potential markets that are much more cost-sensitive. Whether it's commercial remote sensing, taking images of the Earth from space, or some more far-out-looking markets like space manufacturing or space tourism really need lower launch costs to be economically viable. And that's really what SpaceX has been trying to do, is to try and lower that launch price in order to help attract that, generate that additional business that doesn't exist today. A SpaceX Falcon 9 launch right now costs about $60 million. A comparable launch on a different vehicle built by companies both in the U.S. and elsewhere, including Europe and Russia, would cost anywhere from $90 to over $100 million. So they've managed to lower their own launch costs, and that makes them very competitive for many customers. And that's put pressure on some of the existing companies to find ways to become more efficient with their existing vehicles or to develop new vehicles to lower their launch costs. One example is Arianespace, based in France. They operate the Ariane 5 rocket, which is a very large, very successful launch vehicle. It's gone more than 60 consecutive successful launches. It's a very powerful vehicle, but it's also a very expensive vehicle. And so European ministers meeting just in December went ahead and approved plans to develop a new launch vehicle called the Ariane 6 that will be much less expensive to operate than the Ariane 5, with the hope that it will be more competitive with respect to the Falcon 9 than the Ariane 5 is today.
So it seems that SpaceX has so far focused on unmanned launches. What about manned spaceflight? Is that in their future as well?
It certainly is in their future and in the future of other companies as well. NASA helped support SpaceX to develop a system to carry cargo to the space station. Likewise, they are supporting companies to develop systems to carry crews to the International Space Station. With a space shuttle retired, the only way for astronauts to get to and from the space station is to fly on Russian Soyuz spacecraft. And that can be an expensive proposition because Russia charges more than $70 million per seat to fly on a Soyuz. And also, there's no margin for error. If there's ever an accident with a Soyuz or some other problem that keeps the spacecraft grounded, there's no way for crews to get to the space station, and that could result in the space station crew having to evacuate and put the future of the station itself into jeopardy. So having alternative means of accessing the space station is certainly in NASA's interest, and they have for the last few years been funding several companies to begin studies of spacecraft systems that could carry crews to and from the space station. In September, they awarded contracts to two companies, one of them being SpaceX, the other Boeing, to go ahead and proceed with full development of their system. SpaceX is developing a crewed version of their Dragon spacecraft that already carries cargo to the space station, while Boeing is developing a separate spacecraft called the CST-100 that will also be able to carry crews to and from the space station. That will launch on an existing rocket called the Atlas V, which is developed by United Launch Alliance, which is a joint venture of Boeing and Lockheed Martin, two of the big aerospace companies in the United States. So by 2017 or perhaps 2018 at the latest, one or both of those vehicles will be online carrying crews to and from the space station. Those companies will also be free to use those spacecraft for other purposes as well. If they want to use them to fly space tourists, if they want to use them to fly astronauts from other countries, if they want to use them to fly other missions to other space stations. There is a company based in Las Vegas called Bigelow Aerospace that has plans to develop commercial space stations, most likely for research purposes, but also also potentially for tourism as well. Those space stations need a way for astronauts to get to and from those facilities, and having a Dragon or CST-100 available would certainly help their business plan. So there's certainly an opportunity for business beyond the space station for these two companies.
I do want to talk a little bit about space tourism, because I think this is something that really captures the average Joe's imagination, the idea that additional people other than fully trained astronauts and scientists might be able to make it to space one day. So when we think about space tourism, we often think first about Virgin Galactic, because that's really kind of their mission statement. Can you talk a little bit about where Virgin Galactic is right now?
Yeah, you're right. Virgin Galactic is really sort of the leader in the suborbital space tourism market. And what we mean by suborbital are missions that don't go completely into orbit, but go high enough to go into space, an altitude of about 100 kilometers or so, and come right back down. So you get sort of a taste of space flight. You get several minutes of weightlessness. You get a nice view of the Earth out the window, but you don't stay in space for an extended period. Virgin Galactic has its origins back in 2004 with a vehicle called Spaceship One that a company called Scaled Composites, based in Mojave, California, developed for a competition called the Ansari X Prize, which was a $10 million prize competition to develop such a suborbital vehicle. To win the prize, the vehicle had to fly twice in a two-week period, and it had to be capable of carrying at least three people. Spaceship One, which was funded by Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, successfully completed those flights in October of 2004 and won the $10 million prize. Virgin Galactic then signed a deal with Paul Allen and Scale Composites to use that technology developed for Spaceship One for a larger vehicle called Spaceship Two. Spaceship Two, rather than carrying three people, would be able to carry six passengers and two pilots, but it would be the same sort of suborbital space tourism concept. Virgin's been working on that vehicle with Scale Composites for a number of years. The development's taken longer than I think the companies anticipated. They had to scale up Spaceship One, which I think was more complex than they realized. They had to develop a new rocket motor for Spaceship Two that would actually power the vehicle. But they were getting close to beginning commercial flights in October of last year when they performed another test flight. Unfortunately, there was incident. The vehicle broke apart shortly into its powered phase of flight. One of the pilots on board was killed. The other, though, managed to survive and escape with relatively minor injuries. So Virgin Galactic suffered a setback. They are working now on a second Spaceship Two vehicle that they hope to have ready by later this year to begin test flights and potentially have that vehicle ready for commercial service in 2016 and start carrying passengers. The company has about 700 people signed up who have either put down deposits or paid the full ticket price, which, depending on when you bought the ticket, ranges from $200,000 to $250,000 per ticket. A handful of them decided after the accident that they didn't want to fly, but the vast majority have stuck with the company and are moving forward. So potentially at some point next year, some of those people are going to get a chance to fly in space on Spaceship Two.
In the days following the Virgin Galactic crash, I read a few articles that basically said space tourism isn't worth it when it comes to risking test pilots' lives on these new ships. What's your take on that?
Well, everyone has sort of a different risk threshold in terms of what they're willing to accept. I think Virgin Galactic points out that they see space tourism not as an end in and of itself, but as a means towards a greater end of lower cost space access. They have visions of using Spaceship Two for research flights as well as for tourism, carrying experiments and scientists to perform research during those suborbital flights that would cost a lot less than flying to orbit. They also have visions for orbital vehicles. They're working on a system called Launcher One, which would be a small satellite launch vehicle that will use some of the same systems as the Spaceship Two system, but with a different rocket motor design, for example. So certainly they see space tourism as an initial market that they can tap to fly a large number of flights and build up experience and use that as the basis for future vehicles towards that long-term vision of lower cost space access in general.
Is manned spaceflight getting less risky overall? I think it's probably still fairly high risk, but are we looking at bringing that risk reduction down to a certain goalpost before we send average people up there?
I think one thing to keep in mind is, as you note, spaceflight is risky right now. If you look overall at history, the fatality rate is on the order of several percent. It's actually fairly comparable, though, to the risk people face when they try to climb Mount Everest. And many people will climb Mount Everest knowing those risks, knowing that there's a several percent chance that they may not survive, but accept that nonetheless because they want that experience of climbing Mount Everest, even though they won't be the first or even the thousandth person to do so at this point. And I think the same is true in spaceflight. There are a lot of people who want the experience of spaceflight who acknowledge the risks and are willing to accept the risks. For them, it's really all about the experience of spaceflight, in many cases achieving a dream that they may have had since they were a young child decades ago of flying to space, and this is their best way of achieving it. Certainly, the companies involved want to make spaceflight safer. They want to make it much lower odds of injury or death in some of these flights. That'll take time, and it'll take flight experience to do so. But I think right now a lot of the people who are signed up to fly with companies like Virgin Galactic realize that this is a risky endeavor, but to them the benefits, the rewards of the flight are worth those risks.
So what about space mining and manufacturing? Who right now has plans to be the first mining company in space?
You know, space mining was something that seemed firmly in the realm of science fiction until a couple of years ago when a couple of companies announced plans to develop spacecraft to visit near-Earth asteroids. These are asteroids ranging anywhere from a few meters to a few kilometers in diameter that happen to pass close to Earth that contain potentially valuable resources, including water ice, which doesn't seem particularly valuable here on Earth, but in space is extremely valuable. You can use that, obviously, for water for life support, but you can break it down into hydrogen and oxygen, which makes for a pretty potent combination of rocket propellants. One company called Planetary Resources announced plans a couple of years ago to develop a fleet of spacecraft to first prospect asteroids and eventually access those resources, ranging from water ice to even precious metals. There is another company called Deep Space Industries that several months later announced similar plans as well. Now, the actual mining of the asteroids is still pretty far in the future, perhaps a decade or even more before these companies are ready to do that. But they do have plans in the relatively near term to start launching small spacecraft that would prospect these asteroids, first from Earth orbit and then in flybys of these asteroids, to better understand their composition, their structure, how easy it would be to extract resources from them, things you would need to know before you actually proceeded in asteroid mining in earnest. So it's still something that's fairly far in the future, but it's something that some companies are starting to think very seriously about right now.
So you've been following private space and spaceflight projects for a long time now. What's the hook for you that keeps you watching the industry?
Well, and there's so many different things going on. It's a very dynamic industry. You have new companies stepping forward with new business plans and new markets. Not all of these are successful. Many of these companies will fail. And that's not a slight to any of these companies in particular. It's simply just how the market in any new industry shakes out. If you look back at the personal computer industry in the late 70s and early 80s, you saw a lot of companies that don't exist today. You look at sort of the early internet industry in the 1990s, you saw lots of different search engines develop before we ended up with Google. You know, the same thing is going to be true in space. You'll have a lot of these companies make bids to enter this market and fail. But the interesting thing is which ones will succeed and why, with what combination of business plans and technology and markets, or maybe just good luck, will allow them to succeed. And I think that's what makes this particularly compelling. But also in sort of the big picture view is that this is really opening up space to greater applications for people here on Earth. To be able to make greater use of the resources of space, to be able to, for more people to experience space, really provides a lot of benefits to people here on Earth that we may not realize in our day-to-day lives.
Jeff, thanks so much for joining us today.
great. It was a pleasure to be on.
If you want to learn more about Jeff Faust or the private space industry, we definitely recommend checking him out on spacenews.com. You can also check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca to find more great links, including ones to our Twitter feed and Facebook page, where you can keep up with the latest from the Science for the People team. You can also find all our previous episodes online, either at our website or on iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show and check out our entire back catalog. Do also consider leaving a rating and a review as well. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Science for the People.